In our previous lecture, we looked at the Supreme Court's rulings in cases that involve members of the American Communist Party. As we saw, the court ruled in two cases in 1937 that struck down the convictions of communist organizers for violating state laws that punished criminal syndicalism and insurrection. This was a time in which the Communist Party enjoyed a measure of public tolerance and even sympathy for its efforts to organize the unemployed and its resistance to the Nazi regime in Germany. But this tolerance evaporated during the Cold War period that followed World War II, as party leaders attacked the foreign policies of the Truman administration and supported the Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe. The government brought indictments against 12 communist leaders in 1948 under a federal law that punished the advocacy of violent revolution. And the Supreme Court upheld their convictions in 1951, ruling that the party posed a clear and present danger to the nation's security. Now, the court was led during this period by Chief Justice Fred Vinson, who had been named to that position by President Harry Truman after the death in 1946 of Chief Justice Harlan Fiske Stone. The contrast between Stone and Vinson was very clear. As we saw in earlier lectures, Stone had devised the so-called strict scrutiny test of laws that were challenged as violating the Bill of Rights or for discriminating against racial and religious minorities. Stone was also fiercely independent and a man of great integrity. Vinson, on the other hand, gained his position through political loyalty and personal friendship with President Truman. He was a weak leader of a sharply divided court, and he rarely voted against Truman's acts and policies. But this loyalty had a positive effect in one crucial area of the law. Truman firmly supported the civil rights of black Americans, facing the equally firm opposition of the Southern Democrats who controlled the Congress. In fact, the party's diehard segregationists had bolted from the Democratic Convention in 1948 in reaction to the strong civil rights plank in the party's platform. They formed what was called the States' Rights Party and picked Governor Strom Thurmond of South Carolina as their presidential candidate. Although Thurmond pounded on the civil rights issue, he also charged Truman with being soft on communism. Thurmond won more than a million votes and gained the electoral votes of four Deep South states. Civil rights and communism, in fact, were the two issues that dominated American politics during the Truman years. And these were also the issues that dominated the Supreme Court's docket during the Vinson years as well. Truman left the White House in 1953, and Chief Justice Vinson died that same year. Now, these political factors form the backdrop and provide the context for the issues and cases we'll discuss in this lecture. And we'll begin on a biographical note, looking at the life and career of Thurgood Marshall, a remarkable lawyer who played a leading role in all the cases we'll discuss in this lecture. Between 1938 and 1961, Marshall headed the legal office of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. In this post, he argued dozens of civil rights cases before the Supreme Court, winning all but a handful. And he served on the court from 1967 to 1991. The first African-American justice to sit on its bench. It's fair to say that no other man in the nation's history better personified and made a living reality of the words that are chiseled into the court's marble facade, equal justice under law. Marshall became known as Mr. Civil Rights, and it was a title he worked tirelessly to achieve and that he richly deserved. Let me briefly sketch the background of Thurgood Marshall's life. He was born in Baltimore, Maryland, on July 2nd of 1908. Marshall inherited both his name and his feisty temperament from his paternal grandfather, Thorny Good Marshall, who was born a slave in rural Virginia. Over the years, Thorny Good became known as Thurgood, and that was the name on his grandson's birth certificate. Marshall later adopted the shorter name of Thurgood, and his close friends called him Goody. Thorny Marshall had escaped from slavery as a teenager and settled in Baltimore, where he opened a grocery store and raised seven children. His oldest son, Willie, worked as a porter in Baltimore's railroad station and married a schoolteacher, Norma Williams. The Marshalls became part of Baltimore's growing black middle class, Living in a Jim Crow city, but comfortable in a neighborhood with many Jewish and Italian residents. This family history sheds a great deal of light on young Thurgood's upbringing and his later career. His mother encouraged him to excel in school, and his father loved to engage in dinner table debates about politics and the law. "I got the idea of being a lawyer from arguing with my dad," Marshall later said. Marshall's parents impressed on their son his responsibility to use his education and his debating skills to help those who were too poor and too powerless to fight against the Jim Crow system. Marshall went from grade school to Baltimore's Colored High and Training School, where he was elected captain of the debating team. He then joined his older brother, Aubrey, at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, known as the Black Princeton. Marshall again excelled in debate and traveled to Boston for debates with teams from Harvard and British universities. He earned his tuition at Lincoln by waiting on tables at a fancy club on Chesapeake Bay, where his father was the head steward. Marshall loved to tell the story of waiting on a U.S. senator who yelled at him, "Nigger, I want service at this table." Marshall held his tongue and was rewarded with a $20 tip. Marshall's father demanded to know why he accepted this racial abuse. He explained to his dad, "I figure it's worth $20 to be called nigger, but the minute he runs out of 20s, I'll bust him in the nose." Now, I've recounted these stories to make a point about Thurgood Marshall's later career as a lawyer. He could endure racial epithets and hold his tongue, but he used his debating skills and legal training to bust the Jim Crow system in the nose. After he graduated from college, Marshall wanted to attend the University of Maryland's Law School in Baltimore, but it was an all-white school, and he didn't even bother to apply. Instead, he enrolled in the all-black law school at Howard University in Washington, D.C. There he became a disciple of Howard's imposing dean, Charles Hamilton Houston, who trained virtually all of the country's small number of black civil rights lawyers. Houston worked closely with the NAACP and enlisted Marshall to work on the case of a black man who had been charged in Virginia with the murders of two white women. Houston argued the case to an all-white jury, which found his client guilty but spared him from the death penalty. Houston and Marshall celebrated as if they'd won an acquittal. "If you get a life term for a Negro charged with killing a white person in Virginia," Marshall later said, "you've won, because normally they were hanging them." This trial experience had a lasting effect on Marshall, who fought a lifelong battle against capital punishment, arguing that it was imposed most often on poor blacks with poor lawyers to defend them. Charles Houston steered Marshall into civil rights law, and the young lawyer brought his first case against the University of Maryland Law School in 1935. He later said, "I wanted to get even with Maryland for not letting me go to its law school." Marshall found a young black man named Donald Murray, who had graduated from Amherst College in Massachusetts, and persuaded him to apply to Maryland's law school. After the school turned him down, Marshall filed a suit for Murray in state court. He expected to lose the case and to bring an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Surprisingly, the trial judge ordered the law school to admit Murray, and the Maryland Supreme Court upheld his ruling. Donald Murray began his law studies, and Thurgood Marshall lost his first chance to argue before the U.S. Supreme Court, but he had busted the Jim Crow system in the nose. Marshall moved from Baltimore to New York City in 1936 to work in the NAACP's legal department. 2 years later, he assumed the job as the organization's general counsel, heading what was called the Legal Defense and Education Fund. This is now the nation's largest and most influential civil rights law firm, with an annual budget of $9 million and a staff of more than 50 lawyers. But when Marshall took charge, it had a budget of just $10,000, and his salary was only $50 a week. But he made up in dedication and long hours what he lacked in funds to support the legal campaign against Jim Crow laws. We're going to look now at Marshall's role in the legal campaign against racial segregation in public schools. We all know the historic case of Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, in which the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in 1954 that school segregation violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And we'll tell the story of that case in a following lecture. But it's important to look first at the cases that paved the road to the Supreme Court and the Brown decision. It's also important to note that hardly any historic case arrives at the court without years of preparation and dozens of trials and hearings in lower courts. And behind each of the court's landmark rulings are the legal strategies of the lawyers who guide these cases to the court's chamber for argument and final decision. The legal assault on school segregation began some 20 years before the Brown decision, even before Thurgood Marshall became the commanding general in the war on Jim Crow schooling. I'm using these military terms because, in fact, Marshall adopted a military strategy of what I call encirclement and attrition. Now, Marshall based his battle plan on a document that had been drafted for the NAACP in 1931 by a young lawyer named Nathan Margold. He was a protege of Felix Frankfurter, who was then a Harvard law professor and a legal advisor to the NAACP. Margold had been hired to research Jim Crow laws and recommend a long-range litigation strategy against segregation in public education. He prepared a 218-page report that considered two ways to deal with the separate but equal ruling in the Plessy case, in which the Supreme Court had upheld Jim Crow laws in 1896. The first approach would focus on lawsuits designed to force Southern officials to make black and white schools truly equal in quality. This approach had two advantages. First, it would avoid a frontal attack on the Plessy ruling, which stood firmly in the 1930s as precedent. Secondly, judicial orders to equalize school facilities would impose heavy financial burdens on local school boards. They might decide the segregated schools didn't justify the cost of making black schools equal to those for whites. Margold's second approach would assert that separate schools could never be equal because segregation imposed a badge of servitude on black children. This approach had many risks, but one virtue. Judges could not evade the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment in their rulings, and some judges might be willing to distinguish the Plessy ruling, which dealt with segregated railroad cars. People didn't have to ride in railroad cars, but all children had to attend school, and education was the basic function of local governments. Thurgood Marshall dusted off the Margold Report in 1936 when he began working in the NAACP's legal office under Charles Houston. The two lawyers decided that a frontal attack on school segregation in the Deep South was just too risky. The notion of little black boys rubbing knees with little white girls was unthinkable in the 1930s. Marshall and Houston decided instead to mount a flanking attack, beginning with graduate education in border states. Judicial orders to equalize the facilities in higher education, or even to integrate these schools, were less likely to provoke a hostile or violent reaction by white defenders of segregation. And this campaign, if successful, would establish legal precedent for a later assault on the citadel of segregation, grade schools in the Deep South. The strategy of encirclement won its first major victory in 1938. The University of Missouri excluded blacks from its law school. In fact, the state had no law school for blacks. Missouri was a perfect target for the argument that if no separate but equal graduate schools were available to blacks, the state could be forced to admit them to the all-white schools. The NAACP lawyers found a black college graduate, Lloyd Gaines, who applied to the state law school and was turned down because of his race. They filed a suit for Gaines in state court against the university's registrar, whose name was S.W. Canada. Missouri officials quickly offered to pay his tuition if Gaines attended law school in another state, but he demanded admission in Missouri. The Missouri Supreme Court ruled against Gaines, relying on the Plessy ruling for precedent, and the U.S. Supreme Court accepted his appeal. Charles Houston argued the case, with Thurgood Marshall sitting at the counsel table in his first visit to the Supreme Court as a lawyer. Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes wrote for the court in Gaines versus Canada, holding that Missouri could not give whites a legal education in the state and deny blacks that right. But he let Missouri off the hook, ruling that states could provide blacks with equal facilities in separate schools without violating the Constitution. Missouri lawmakers promptly established a black law school at Lincoln University, the state's all-black school of higher education. The NAACP lawyers planned another suit based on the claim that the separate law school for blacks was unequal in quality to the white institution. But they never filed this suit because Lloyd Gaines took the money the NAACP had raised for his tuition and simply disappeared from sight. But the precedent of the Gaines case remained. States could not deny black students admission to white graduate schools without providing them with supposedly equal facilities within the state. Now, World War II interrupted the NAACP's campaign against segregated education. Thurgood Marshall was busy fighting to protect black soldiers in the Jim Crow Army and Navy from hostile treatment by white officers. He also pushed to enforce federal policies against discrimination in defense jobs. Marshall finally made his first Supreme Court argument in 1943, winning an important ruling that struck down primary elections in Texas from which black voters were excluded. Marshall celebrated his victory with a party at NAACP headquarters, at which liquor flowed freely and the phones went unanswered. The next day, Justice Frank Murphy called from the Supreme Court to congratulate Marshall, explaining that he couldn't reach him the night before. "I apologize profusely," Marshall later said, and Murphy agreed that a guy had a right to get drunk at a time like that. Marshall was completely sober when he appeared before the court in 1948 to make his next attack on segregated graduate education. His client in this case was a young woman named Ada Lois Sipewell. She had graduated with honors from Oklahoma's State College for Negroes and applied in 1946 to the state's all-white law school. She was denied admission and was promised that a black law school with substantially equal facilities would soon be established. But the school never materialized, and Marshall filed a suit in state court to order her admission to the white law school. State judges relied on the Plessy ruling in dismissing her suit, and the Supreme Court granted Marshall's petition for review in Sipewell versus Oklahoma Board of Regents. This was an easy case for the justices. 4 days after Marshall's argument, they unanimously ordered Oklahoma to provide Ada Sipewell with a legal education as soon as it does for applicants of any other group. The court's brief and unsigned opinion cited the Gaines decision as precedent. Oklahoma officials responded by roping off a section of the state capitol building and calling it a law school. This pretend school had no library and no faculty of its own, and Ada Sipewell refused to be a pretend student. Marshall asked the Supreme Court to rule that Oklahoma had evaded its previous order. Over the dissents of Justices Frank Murphy and Wiley Rutledge, the justices sent the case back to state court for hearings on whether the separate law school was equal in quality to the all-white school. Marshall lost again in the state court and prepared another Supreme Court appeal. But in 1949, Oklahoma officials gave up their legal battle and admitted Ada Sipewell to its real law school. After she was admitted, the Oklahoma legislature passed a law requiring that education for black students in formerly white universities be provided, as the law stated, upon a segregated basis, in separate classrooms, or at separate times. The law school didn't keep Sipewell out of its classrooms, but she had to sit 4 rows behind the white students under a sign that read colored. She also had to eat in a separate chained-off area in the law school cafeteria, guarded by university police. These vestiges of the Jim Crow system rankled another black student at the University of Oklahoma. George McLaurin had been admitted to the Graduate School of Education in 1949 after university officials conceded defeat in Ada Sipewell's case. McLaurin was then in his 60s and had taught for decades in black public schools. He held a master's degree in education and now sought a doctorate. But his supposedly equal education came with conditions. Unlike Sipewell, who sat in the back of her classrooms, McLaurin was forced to listen to lectures from a hallway next to a sign that read, "Reserved for Colored." He could study at a colored desk on the library's mezzanine, but not in the reading room. He could eat at a colored table in the cafeteria, but only after white students finished their meals. And twice a day, the white sign was removed from the men's room and replaced with a colored sign. McLaurin objected to this demeaning treatment, and NAACP lawyers challenged his treatment in federal court. After a panel of federal judges upheld the state law, Thurgood Marshall filed an appeal with the Supreme Court. The McLaurin case reached the court in 1950, along with another challenge to segregated legal education from the state of Texas. In this case, a black postal worker named Heman Sweat had been denied admission in 1946 by the University of Texas Law School in the state capital of Austin. The state had no law school for blacks, and Thurgood Marshall filed a suit in state court for Sweat against the university's registrar, whose last name was Painter. The Texas judges gave the university 6 months to offer Sweat a legal education substantially equivalent to that provided for whites. Charles McCormick, the dean of the all-white school, quickly offered plans for an all-black law school. It would occupy 4 basement rooms in an office building in Austin. It would have no library, and it would employ 4 part-time instructors. McCormick would also serve as the new school's dean. Marshall promptly challenged these plans, and state judges ordered a second hearing, at which McCormick testified that the 2 schools were equal in quality. The Texas judges agreed that 4 rooms for blacks equaled the massive building in which 850 white students took classes. Marshall filed an appeal from this ruling with the Supreme Court, which scheduled arguments in both the Sweat and McLaurin cases in April of 1950. Hundreds of people lined up to get seats in the court's chamber for these arguments, and Marshall played to his audience with an emotional appeal to the justices. The state of Texas had submitted a brief that was joined by lawyers for all 11 of the former Confederate states, arguing that school segregation in these states reflected the wishes of their citizens, both white and black. Marshall answered this claim with heated words, "It matters not to me whether every single Negro in this country wants segregated schools," he said. "It makes no difference whether every white person wants segregated schools. If Sweat wants to assert his individual constitutional right, it cannot be conditioned upon the wishes of every other citizen." Price Daniel, the Attorney General of Texas, responded by saying that if Heman Sweat was admitted to the University of Texas Law School, then blacks would have to be given access to swimming pools, hospitals, and grade schools that were reserved for whites. Daniel knew that Marshall had recently filed a suit against grade school segregation in a rural South Carolina county, a case we'll discuss in the following lecture. And he feared that Marshall would use a favorable ruling in the Sweat case to bolster his attack on Jim Crow schools across the South. That's why all the Southern states had joined the Texas brief, hoping to head off the legal attack they saw coming. Actually, both sides won a partial victory in the Sweat case. Ruling in June of 1950, the court unanimously ordered the University of Texas to admit Heman Sweat to its all-white law school. Chief Justice Fred Vinson wrote for the court and compared the new all-black school to the prestigious facility in Austin. He noted the obvious disparities between the two schools in terms of faculty, libraries, and physical plants. But those factors counted less to Vinson than what he called those qualities which are incapable of objective measurement, but which make for greatness in a law school. These factors included, as Vinson wrote, the influence of the alumni, standing in the community, traditions, and prestige. Measured on this scale, Vincent concluded, it is difficult to believe that one who has a free choice between these schools would consider the question close. But the state of Texas and its southern allies did not leave the court's chamber empty-handed. Thurgood Marshall had urged the justices to overrule the separate but equal doctrine of the Plessy case. Chief Justice Vinson declined the invitation. Having ruled that the white and black law schools in Texas were not equal in quality, Vinson explained, the court had no reason to decide if Plessy should be examined, as he wrote, in the light of contemporary knowledge respecting the purposes of the 14th Amendment and the effects of racial segregation. That was an issue for later decisions, as we'll see in following lectures. Thurgood Marshall called Heman Sweat with the good news of his legal victory. Texas had learned, Marshall said, that you have to age law schools like good whiskey. And the whiskey flowed at the celebration in the NAACP's offices. Constance Baker Motley, a young lawyer on Marshall's staff who later became a federal judge, talked about her boss. Thurgood, he's a party man, she said. Anytime we won a case, people came by because they knew there was a party going on. There's a sad footnote to this case. Heman Sweat entered the University of Texas Law School in the fall of 1950, but his fellow students did not welcome their black classmate. He found a cross burning next to his car, and his tires were slashed. He missed several weeks of class from an appendectomy, and his marriage crumbled under the stress. By the end of Sweat's second year, his grades plummeted, and he flunked out, worn down by these pressures. He later earned a social work degree and worked for the Urban League for 20 years before his death in 1982. 5 years later, the University of Texas Law School initiated a yearly Heman Sweat Symposium on Civil Rights, belatedly recognizing the courage of a man the school had asked the Supreme Court to keep out of its classrooms. George McLaurin fared better than Heman Sweat. Chief Justice Vinson wrote a brief opinion for a unanimous court. Forcing McLaurin to occupy colored seats in the classroom, library, and cafeteria, Vinson said, was bound to impair and inhibit his ability to study, to engage in discussions and exchange views with other students, and in general, to learn his profession. McLaurin must receive the same treatment at the hands of the state as students of other races. Vinson instructed the university to take down the colored signs, and McLaurin taught the university a lesson. He never completed his doctorate, but his fellow students, most of them much younger than McLaurin, welcomed the experience and insight he added to classroom discussions. He spent his last years in Los Angeles and died in 1968. The University of Oklahoma now recognizes both Ada Sipewell and George McLaurin among its distinguished alumni. In 1992, Oklahoma's governor named Sipewell to the university's Board of Regents, the same body she had sued in 1947. She pledged to protect minority students from discrimination. Having suffered severely from bigotry and racial discrimination, she said, I am sensitive to that kind of thing. As we've seen in this lecture, Thurgood Marshall successfully employed his strategy of encirclement and attrition in the initial stages of the legal campaign against Jim Crow schooling. His judicial victories in border states, forcing universities to admit black students to formerly all-white schools, set the stage for the final assault on Jim Crow schooling in the Deep South. In our next lecture, we'll continue this story by looking at the five cases Marshall brought to the Supreme Court, challenging school segregation in four states and the nation's capital. These were the cases that culminated in the historic Brown decision in 1954.